gunny sacks full of duck feathers waiting to be made into pillows when she got time. The ducks themselves, they hung out to freeze and then strung up in long lines in the bathhouse, but it was early in the season for freezing down meat, and Elsa eyed them dubiously, afraid they might all spoil. They did. The weather turned warm. The frozen ground softened and turned to mud. Beau was in a frenzy. 100 ducks out there, enough for 50 meals, 2 months' meat, and the damned thermometer jumped up to 45 degrees. He rushed down to Jaime Gross to see if they could be packed in Jaime's ice house, but Jaime's ice house was nothing but damp sawdust. There wouldn't be any ice until the river froze. "God damn!" Beau said. He stood for a minute, thinking, and then started toward home, took the key from the kitchen door, and went out to the bathhouse. It felt cold inside when he stepped in, but not cold enough. He felt one of the ducks hanging from the wire, beginning to soften. He swore again, his eyes darting around the bare room with the benches, the dirty inscriptions, the nails where clothes and bathing suits were hung in the summer. There was a step outside, and Elsa looked in.
"How are they?" she said.
She held her hand up, feeling the air.
"It feels pretty cold yet. Maybe they'll last till night, and it'll get colder then."
He shook his head, looking at the strings of ducks, fat, meaty, their necks stretched from hanging and their webbed feet dangling.
"Have you got any empty fruit sealers?"
"A dozen or so, maybe." She looked doubtfully at the ducks.
"Would that work?"
"Well, something's got to work," he shouted at her. "Have you got any better ideas?"
"It seems a shame," she said. "The jars I've got wouldn't save more than a few."
"I know that." He clicked his teeth, wanting to cut loose and kick the bench away from the wall. Violent impulses jumped in his hands and feet, and he went abruptly outside. Elsa came after him.
"I'll go get the jars boiling," she said hurriedly,
and with a side glance at him, went back to the house. Beau stood where he was, looking out over the cut bank, across the river to the low, thick scrub of willow and alder and black birch. It never failed. You worked your head off, and then something went sour. His mind groped for an object to curse, something to vent his anger on. A tin can lay at his feet, and with one swing he booted it 30 feet into the river. Well, there were only 4 ways of preserving meat that he knew of. Freezing was out because of the thaw, canning would take care of only a few ducks, and jars were too expensive to buy. Drying was out of the question in this weather. So there was only smoking left. He had never heard of smoked duck, but by God there was going to be plenty of smoked duck this winter. He locked the bathhouse door and, lurching in his haste, started for the barn to get tools and boards to knock together a smokehouse. At the end of 5 days, he gave up. The ducks which had hung in the smoke, wizened, dried, blackened things, were rubbery and evil-tasting. The combination of gamey flavor and smoke was enough, he said, to turn the stomach of a vulture. He tasted them raw, and they sickened him. He boiled one, and the smell drove him from the house. Finally, he threw the whole lot of them in the river, and all they had from his furious hunting was 12 jars of canned duck and a few of duck soup. By October 28th, the river was filmed with brittle ice under the wagons coming down from the bench and fording below Purcell's. There were many wagons. Beau, driven to prowl the town and sit in Anderson's pool hall, saw 24 men he did not recognize, and the street was full of strange women and children. The town wore a look of unaccustomed activity, as if for Thanksgiving or Christmas, but there was little holiday feeling. Faces were long and talk somber, and they talked of 3 things: the war, the price of food, and the flu. Beau had been too busy to pay any attention to the flu, but listening to the farmers who hung around the pool hall, he heard the fear in their talk. Out on the prairie, miles from town or a doctor, a man got thinking. There was never a winter that some homesteader didn't get snowed in, or break his leg, or cut himself with an axe, and then sit there in his shanty, unable to help himself, sitting with his sheepskin on and all his blankets over that, hoarding his fuel, while his wound festered and swelled, and the shack got colder, and almost every spring some such homesteader was found frozen stiff. Suppose, then, a whole family got sick with this flu and no help around, and winter setting in solid and cold 3 weeks early. It was supposing things like this that drove in the homesteaders in wagons piled with goods to settle down on some relative or friend or in vacant rooms. Three families had gone together and cobbled up a shack, half house and half tent, in the curve of the willows east of the elevators. Even a tent in town was better in these times than a house out on the bitter flats. The papers they read didn't reassure them. On both coasts, the hospitals were jammed, the army camps were crowded with sick soldiers, whole inland parts of the country were virtually isolated. Because there was no safe place to run to, people stayed, but they took it easy about going outdoors. They doctored colds as if they were pneumonia. They kept their children home from school if a sniffle was heard in the primary room. They soused their handkerchiefs with the eucalyptus oil that Henderson, the druggist, said was a preventative. And they sat in Anderson's pool hall and talked. Once Beau sat for a solid hour, hearing how the disease turned you black as ink just before it killed you, and how people in the last stages rose from their beds and ran screaming and gibbering through the streets, foaming at the mouth and biting anyone who got in their way. Beau hawked in disgust and got up to take a drink from the water pail in back. As he lifted the dipper, he saw the yellow-green moss coating the tin bottom and dumped the water angrily on the floor. With his fingernail, he traced a skull and crossbones in the bottom of the dipper, digging the scum off clear to the stained metal, and hung the thing up again. No wonder these guys were scared of the flu. They had a right to be, with things like that left around to drink out of. Back at the bar, sticky and smelling sweetly of strawberry pop, he drummed his fingers on the counter and looked at Ed Anderson. Ed had had an eye knocked out by an exploding pop bottle the year before and wore a black patch. "I don't suppose you've got a bottle of beer in the joint," Beau said. Mopping off the counter, Ed turned to spit at a hidden spittoon. "I would if I could, boy," he said. "You just can't get it, even if the cops would let you sell it." Beau drummed again, looking out the dirty windows into the street. He turned his head and inspected the half-dozen men hanging around the front end, and cleaned his teeth with his tongue. Bunch of dung-footed dirt farmers. He contemplated them with contempt, wondering if it would do any good to try getting up a little stud game. But he gave it up immediately. If they were too leaded to play pool, they wouldn't play poker. They didn't even have spirit enough to crab about the prohibition law that kept them from having a schooner of beer. "What's the matter with this town?" he said irritably. "Isn't there even anybody in it with gumption enough to start a blind pig, even? What's the matter with you, Ed? You don't look like a Christer." "I ain't any Christer," Ed said. "But I'm telling you, you can't get it. Where'd I buy it?" "There must be somebody got it for sale. When I was selling beer on the road in Dakota, I did my whole business with blind pigs." The half-dozen loungers were all looking at him. "What I wish," one said, "is that you could get a bottle of good strong liquor sauce in this place. If that old flu lights around here, I want to crawl in bed with a bottle." "Ain't it the truth," Ed said. "If I had 10 cases behind this bar, I could sell out in 3 days. "You could get $5 a bottle for it, too," Beau said. Ed's one eye, pale, with strained red streaks in it, opened in agreement, and he jerked his head sideways to shoot at the spittoon again. "You tell him," he said. "If a guy wants something bad enough, he'll pay anything." Beau stood up. "Well," he said, "if bullshitting around would get a man a drink, I'd be stiff as a plank now. Anybody want to shoot a game of pool?" Nobody did. Dissatisfied and aimless, he got into the dogskin and wandered outside. Weddy Arulian's great wife, thick and pillowy and wide as a sidewalk, the mother of 9 children and enormous now with her 10th, went up the street on the other side and waved a bulky arm, grinning and yelling at him. Beau waved back. That old squaw common as manure. But she had fun. About the only cheerful thing in the whole damn town. He was disgusted, vaguely grouchy, irrationally sore at the farmers who sat around Anderson's all day and couldn't think of anything to do but tell bear stories about the flu. Every one of them wanted a drink or a bottle, but would they do anything to get it? They'd sit on their behinds and cry. That was all they'd do. It was only 100 miles to Chinook, less than that to some of the smaller Montana towns. If they wanted a drink as bad as they said, they could drive over any time, get a carload, bring it back into Canada over any of 100 little unwatched wagon track trails. In the middle of the plank sidewalk, he stopped short. An incredulous laugh burst out of him. "Holy jumping Jesus," he said softly. "I've been sitting right on top of a gold mine." Briefly, automatically, he wished for Judd. Judd was the only partner he had ever had, a guy you could depend on to come in on anything worth a gamble. But Judd was dead in Alaska, and there was nobody in town he could go to for money, nobody he wanted to cut into this proposition. The only possibility was Chapman at the bank, and Chapman would have to be talked to like a Dutch uncle. As he passed McKenna's store on the way to the bank, another thought struck him, and he turned up the stairs to Dr. O'Malley's office. The doctor was in, sitting on his desk. He had a young, fresh face and an easy grin, and his sleeves, even in the chilly office, were rolled up above the elbows. Beau noticed that his arms were brown and corded with muscle. The kid was more man than he looked.
"Want to ask you a question," Beau said.
"Shoot."
"About this flu."
O'Malley's eyebrows lifted.
"I've been answering that one for 3 weeks. Stay out of drafts, avoid catching cold, don't go outside when you're overheated, don't hang around in crowds or go to the picture palace."
He grinned.
"And pray," he said.
Beau grunted. "That isn't the question.
I want to know if whiskey is good for the flu."
"Whiskey's good for almost anything," O'Malley said. "Except DTs. Why?"
"It's a medicine, isn't it? You'd say it was a good medicine for this influenza."
O'Malley laughed.
"I guess it must be medicine. The druggist, the only person in town allowed to sell it. I've worn out a prescription pad helping him."
"That's all I want to know. Thanks."
The doctor's puzzled frown followed him to the door. With one hand on the knob, Beau turned.
"How's your own stock?"
"I haven't got any," O'Malley said. "I'm not in the liquor business. Sell you some nice Ipecac."
"I don't want to buy any. I'm asking you if you want to buy any."
He shoved his hands deep into the pockets of the dogskin.
"They've been saying that if the flu hits here, the town will be quarantined. Is that right?"
"Yes."
"And if it's quarantined, there won't be any trains in or out?"
"No."
"And if there aren't any trains, there won't be any more supplies for Henderson?"
"I asked him already to lay in a lot of salts and quinine and eucalyptus oil. We'll be cut off for a while, sure."
"But you didn't have him lay in any whiskey.
Want me to bring you some?"
O'Malley sat down on the desk and slowly rolled down his sleeves, buttoning them neatly around his wrists.
"It's against the law, you know."
"This is an emergency," Beau said.
"If it weren't," O'Malley said, "I wouldn't be talking to you.
How much do you want for Irish?"
Beau guessed, guessing plenty high.
$6 a bottle."
"I'm used to paying around 3.5, the doctor said.
"But you haven't been able to get any."
The doctor stood up and reached for his coat on the hanger.
"How much for a case?"
"Make it to you for 65.
O'Malley rummaged in a drawer, came out again empty-handed, and faced Beau.
"All right," he said. "Only there's this. You going to Montana after it?"
"I didn't say."
The doctor's voice sharpened.
"I have to know just the same. A lot of towns in Montana are quarantined already. I can connive to break the liquor law in an emergency, but if you're breaking quarantines to bring this whiskey in, I'm out."
"You needn't worry," Beau said. "The place I'm getting this isn't quarantined."
O'Malley held his eyes a minute.
"All right," he said shortly. "A case of Irish, Bushmills or Jameson's."
Beau nodded and went downstairs again, his mind jumping with figures. It was a dead immortal cinch.
If he couldn't buy a case of Irish for 35 at the most, he'd kiss a pig. Maybe less if he bought a lot, 10 cases or so. His mind jumped again. 10? The old Lizzie ought to carry 12 or 15. Maybe get a pony cask and decant it. Sell plain old corn for $3 a bottle.
John Chapman was sitting alone in the bank, peeling an apple carefully, the unbroken spiral peel hanging like a shaving as he turned the fruit. Bo watched him till the peel fell into the wastebasket, watched him halve and then quarter the white meat, and then asked for his loan. $200 for 2 weeks. Chapman deliberated. There was already a mortgage on Bo's house, and no payment on the principal for a year and a half.
"What security?" he said. "How about my team?"
Very tall and bulky, Chapman sat and spread his hands.
"If you didn't meet your obligation, I couldn't get 200 for a team. I couldn't get 100 this time of year."
"Listen," Bo said, "this is no bread-and-butter loan, see? I'll have that money back to you in a week, maybe less. You can have the team, the colt, 2 cows, and anything else you think you want, if you let me have 200 right now, American money."
"You sound pretty sure of yourself," Chapman said.
"It's foolproof," said Bo. "I don't even give a damn what interest you charge me, because I'll be paying this back before you know it's out of your safe."
A half hour later, he went home carrying a bag of American silver dollars and some bills, all the American money Chapman had. He kept the bag hidden under the hall seat until after supper when the boys were sent up to bed. Even then he did not bring it out, but sat, figuring. He ought to be able to get $50 a case for good liquor, and if he couldn't buy it for around 25, there was something wrong. He could double his money. And suppose he got a 20-gallon keg of corn. It shouldn't cost more than $5 a gallon that way, and he could get $3 a quart just like spitting in a stove door. Gold mine, he said. I hope to whisk in your piskers it's a gold mine. He lifted his eyes and looked at Elsa, her head bent over her darning.
How much money have we got?
She smiled. Figuring again? There's nothing wrong with knowing where you stand. Have we got any left? I paid McKenna and the hardware store, she said, and I laid out what we owe Hoffman for seed. There's not much left.
Well, let's count it up and see. The less there is, the easier it is to count.
While she was upstairs getting her purse, he slipped into the hall, got the bag, and concealed it under his chair. Elsa came down and laid the purse on the table. "There's our worldly wealth," she said, and laughed. Bo opened the purse and counted out $122. The hundred he smoothed out, folded, smoothed again, and laid aside. The 22 he put back in the purse. Elsa watched him. He could see the curiosity and the anxiety in her face.
"What would you say," he said, "if I told you I could turn that 100 into 240 in 3 days?"
He lifted the bills between his fingers, passed the other hand over them, waved his fingers. "Nothing up the sleeve," he said. He opened his right hand. "Nothing in the hand. Presto, changeo, pshht!" He palmed the bills and showed her his empty hands and grinned. 3 days from now I'll make it return with 140 more." The anxiety had not left her face.
"You've got some deal on. What is it?"
"Starting with $300, he said, "I can be worth over 600 by the end of the week."
"But you haven't got 300 to start."
He reached under the chair and got the bag, set it with a metallic clump on the table, untied the neck, and poured a flood of silver dollars on the cloth.
"Well, where on earth?" she said.
Expertly, he stacked 2 piles of dollars, shuffled them, melted them into one pile with a smooth, drawing motion.
"We're out of the woods," he said.
She was facing him with her hands on the table, as if ready to rise.
"Where did you get this?"
"Borrowed it."
"Who from?"
"Chapman."
"But—"
He got up and went around to her.
"This is how it is," he said, with his hands on her shoulders. "The flu will hit us, sure. It's already in Regina. And when it comes, there won't be any way of getting in and out or of bringing medicine in.
so I'm going after some, to Chinook. I talked with the Sawbones this afternoon.
But why should you have to borrow all this money?
Because I'm making the profit. You know what the best medicine for flu is?
Eucalyptus oil, she said.
I don't know. Good old-fashioned corn whiskey. So I'm going out like an old St. Bernard with a keg around my neck.
He felt her stiffen under his hands, and she leaned forward.
Whiskey business, she said. It isn't whiskey business, he said in irritation. Their damn fool prohibition law might kill off the whole town. Ask Doc O'Malley. He wants a case of Irish himself.
She stared across the table at the stacks of dollars.
What if you get caught? All caught. Who's going to be running around that prairie trying to catch anybody? Anyway, it's a medical emergency.
When she said nothing for a long time, it pulled her chair sideways and looked at her face.
You still don't like it, he said.
I hate to see you get into that illegal business again, she said. And it's dangerous. What if a blizzard came up or you got sick on the road?
I might dislocate my jaw yawning, too, he said. Hell, I can drive over there and back in less than 2 days.
I wonder, she said. I bet you it's snowing right now.
He went to the window and looked. The yellow panes of Chance's house next door were streaked with wavering white.
It isn't even the end of October yet, he said. This'll be gone by morning. Even if it isn't, I can wait a day.
Elsa came up and took his arm, and he looked down at her worried face.
Bo, she said, I wish you wouldn't.
For a moment he stood, almost hating her, hating the way she and the kids hung on him and held him back, loaded him with responsibilities, and then hamstrung him when he tried to do anything. His teeth clicked, but he waited till the anger passed.
Look, he said wearily, this town's played out. It played out 2 or 3 years ago. Do you think I'd be sticking around here if it wasn't for you and the kids? I'd be off somewhere where there was money to be made, wouldn't I? Well, I'm sticking here, but you can't expect me not to make a living any way I can.
You brought us up here, she said. You said you didn't want to live anywhere without us. I believed you then, Bo.
In spite of himself, he heard his voice rising, and he faced her, shaking-handed.
I'm sticking, he shouted. I haven't run away, have I? I built you a house and made you a home, didn't I? But how in hell are we going to live in it without any money?
Elsa looked at him, silent for a moment.
All right, she said.
I said when I came back that I'd never try to interfere with you again. I made up my mind that I was your wife and I'd stay your wife no matter what. But I just want you to remember, Bo, that I never asked for more than we had. I'd have been satisfied with just a bare living if we could only keep what we've had up here. So don't ever say you did this for me or them. Don't ever forget that I was against it.
Their eyes held for a moment, and he turned half away to look out the window. After a minute, Elsa's hand touched his arm lightly.
Poor Bo, she said.
When he turned back, her eyes were shining with tears.
Poor Elsa, you mean, he said. Oh, damn it, honey. You think I like to see us down to $100 with a whole winter ahead?
No, you don't, she said.
She moved against him, and he put his arms around her.
What you don't see, she said, what you'll never see is that there are things 10 times worse than being poor.
I guess I never will, he said. Maybe you think it would be fun to go hungry, but I don't.
So you still think you'll go?
He held her tightly against him, looking over her head at the open sack of money on the table, and his mind shut hard and tight.
I've got to, he said. Whether you see it or not.
It still snowed in the morning, not heavily but persistently, with a driving wind. For a few minutes, Bo contemplated going away, but it was too thick, and with all the homesteaders crowded into the towns, there would be no place to stop along the road if anything went wrong. So he spent the day canvassing the town discreetly,
getting orders for 5 cases more without even propositioning the crowd at Anderson's. They were bulk rye prospects anyway. That afternoon he worked on the Ford in the shed. Under the seat he put a 6 cans of canned heat, 2 spare spark plugs, a couple pair of chains, and a little bottle of ether, trying to prepare for any sort of emergency. When a car wouldn't start, he had heard, a little ether in the spark plug wells was like turpentine on a balky mule. With all that whiskey aboard, he wasn't going to run any chance of getting stuck. He even cut up an old horse blanket, doubled it, and sewed it into a crude cover for the radiator. If the weather turned cold, the radiator could freeze even with the motor running, and you wouldn't know it till you cracked the head or did some real damage. There was gasoline left from the drum to fill the tank and a 5-gallon can. At the last minute, looking around for final preparations, Beau took out the back seat and set it against the wall. The car would hold more with the seat out. After supper, he sat in the kitchen while Elsa fried a chicken for his box lunch. It was Halloween, and the boys were both out. Beau kept going to the door and looking out. The snow had stopped, but the ground was humped with drifts, and it was still blowing. From the direction of town, he heard the distant yelling of kids. "If those shysters come horsing around the shed and bung up that car, I'll fill their behinds with birdshot," he said.
"It's locked, isn't it?"
"Locks don't stop kids when they get going on a tear."
"I'll stay up and watch," she said. "You should get to sleep early."
He looked at her curiously, wondering how much she still objected, how much she was swallowing. She had a habit of swallowing things, and then years later you discovered that she hadn't forgotten them. The kitchen door swung open, and Chet and Bruce rushed in. Their noses were red and leaking with the cold, their eyes starting out.
"The flu's hit town," they said in a breathless burst. "Old Mrs. Rieger's got it."
Beau shut the door. "How do you know?"
"Mr. McGregor said we were out behind the chinks, and he called us and said not to play any tricks because the flu was in town, and now all the kids are distributing flu masks and eucalyptus oil, and we're going back right now."
"No, you're not," Beau said. He looked at Elsa. "You chase these snickle fritzes up to bed. I'm going uptown to see what's going on."
"You won't be able to go now," she said,
and the relief in her voice made him mad.
"The town will be quarantined."
"That quarantine's nothing but a word," he said. "The town really needs the stuff now."
"Go where?" Chet said.
His father pushed him into the dining room. "None of your beeswax. Go on up to bed, both of you." An hour uptown told him nothing he didn't know. Nobody would be allowed in or out of town, but that just made him grin. He could imagine people sitting out along the roads in the cold to warn people. Like hell, they'd be sealed up tight in their houses. At 10 o'clock he went home from the darkened and deserted main street, stoked the parlor heater for the night, and went up to bed. All the actual coming of the flu did was to make it surer that he could sell all the whiskey the Ford would carry. Chapter 2 In the clear, gray-and-white morning, he carried blankets and lunchbox out to the shed. The snow had blown during the night, and a foot-deep drift, with a deep bluish hollow at its inner edge, curved around the corner of the barn. The thermometer read 22 above zero. The Ford smelled cold. It was hard to imagine that anything so cold would ever start. Dumping the blankets and lunch, he went back to the house, dipped 2 steaming pails of water from the water jacket of the range, and lugged them back out. They took careful pouring in the tiny hole, and he squinted in the gray indoor light, concentrating. When he had the radiator full, he bent to feel the crank, engaged it, tried 1/2 a turn. It was like trying to lift the car with 1 hand. The cold oil gave heavily, reluctantly, to the crankshafts turning. Whistling through his teeth, he went around to adjust spark and gas levers and switch the key to battery. Then, with 1 finger hooked in the choke wire, he bent and heaved, fighting the stiff inwards of the motor around. On his cheek he could feel the dim warmth of the water he had poured in. 3 minutes of laborious heaving loosened the crankshaft a little. He pulled the choke full out and threw his whole weight into the spin. After 2 ponderous twirls, the motor coughed. "Ha!" he said. He
He spun again, and again it coughed. It was a good feeling to have that stubborn, frozen block of complicated metal giving before his pressure. He felt strong, heavy, able to twist the Ford any way he wanted to. The muscles hardened in his shoulder, and he heaved. The motor coughed, caught, roared, died again in spite of his frantic coaxing of the choke wire. Another spin, and it roared again, banging his knuckles against the mudguard. He choked it in quick bursts, laid his shoulder against the radiator to hold back the Ford's trembling, nuzzling eagerness, and watching his chance, ran around to pull down the spark and push up the gas lever. Only a frantic grab at the choke kept it from dying, and he nursed it carefully, leaning far inside the side-curtained darkness of the front seat. The switch to magneto was crucial. She survived it. He slipped the gas lever up and down, and she roared. "Okay, you old bugger," he said, and leaving it running, went back to the house, sucking his skinned knuckles. The boys were up, crowding their bottoms into the oven door and regarding the preparations with blurred and wondering eyes. Beau warmed his hands briefly before pulling on the big double mitts. When he picked up the bag of money, he met Elsa's sober look. "Now don't you worry, sis."
"How can I help worrying? 1,000 things could happen."
"You never saw me get into anything I couldn't get out of, did you?"
"There's always a first time," she said.
"Where's Pa going?" Chet said.
"Just on a little trip,"
Elsa said. She reached up to touch Beau's cheek.
"Be awfully careful," she said.
He bent and kissed her, sparred a moment with the boys in farewell, and eyed them all seriously from the doorway. "It wouldn't do to get into any trouble on this trip with the flu in town." "You stay close," he said to Elsa. "I ought to be back tomorrow night, but if I'm not, don't worry. Something might hold me up till the day after." He ducked out, swinging the heavy bag of dollars, and ran down the path, feeling light, agile, like a boy again. As he drove out of the shed and bucked through a drift into the road up past Van Damme's toward the oil derrick, he booped once on the rubber horn to Elsa, standing in the doorway with her arms folded across her breast and watching him. The wind had blown from the north all night, and the dugway up to the south bench was almost bare. But on the bench the snow lay in long, ripple-marked drifts, not deep, but deep enough to hide the road in spots. There had been no guard or hindrance, not even a sign along the road as he left town. Beau folded a blanket on the floorboards to set his feet on. It was cold, but not too cold, and he was glad for the absence of wind. The sun, flat along the bench, burned on the crests of the drifts, and the air in front of the car glittered with sun-struck motes of frost. Close in, the fences and the Russian thistle jammed against them had kept the road fairly clear, and even where the fences gave out, the drifts were nowhere more than a foot deep. The snow was so granular, almost like coarse sand, that he rode over it as he might have over a hard-packed beach. There was no sign of life, no smoke, in the homesteads he passed. The pastures were empty of stock. As the farms thinned out and the fences broke off at right angles to leave the road unmarked, the drifts were more frequent, and he had to look far ahead to the spots blown bare to make sure of staying on the trail. Once, bucking across a long drift, he dipped down in a swale and bogged down. 3 minutes after he had shoveled out, he ran smack into a fence, and there was no gate. He got out to look around, but there was nothing to tell him where he was, only the dazzle of sun on snow and the patches of beaten and frozen grass. Climbing in again, he cramped the wheels sharp left and bumped along the fence. Within a half mile he came to a gate and recognized it. He was at the edge of the horse pasture. That wasn't so bad. He'd be at his own homestead by noon, could stop off and have lunch inside, warm up a little before going on. Experimentally, he moved his toes inside the heavy socks and elk-hide moccasins. Not cold yet, just a little stiff from sitting still. He was lost twice in the horse pasture, finding his way back into the road each time by following the water ditch. Once he had to shovel out. When he pulled up toward Gadke's at 11:30, he decided to stop there rather than go on to the homestead. Any story would do to tell them. He was being sent for flu medicine, that was all.
But there was no one at Gadkey's. The barn doors were nailed shut with cleats. The blinds in the house were drawn. Bo swore, kicking his numb feet together, and pulled out again. It was the homestead for lunch after all. For a while he pounded his feet on the blanket and sang to keep warm, but it was too hard to follow the trail and sing at the same time. The biggest branch of the trail turned off just past Gadkey's and left only a pair of shallow ruts. In undrifted snow he could have followed them, but the drifts changed everything. In 10 more minutes he was off the road again. He swung left in a wide circle, but there were only drifts and bare grass. Under one wheel the bottom fell out of a drifted burnout, and the shock rattled his teeth. The motor died, and he had to get out and crank. It infuriated him to be lost in a country he had driven through 2 dozen times. It was the damned snow. Everything looked different. "All right," he said, and climbed in again. "Lose the road, drive by ear." The sun was straight ahead of him. He couldn't go far wrong if he headed straight south, unless he hit a coulee he couldn't cross. The burnouts were enough to kink his neck, but if the Ford could stand them, he could. Within a mile he came to the edge of a coulee 10 or 15 feet deep and 100 wide. "Damn," he said, and sat peering through the windshield. The snow was deep in the coulee bottom, too deep. So it was go around. He cramped the wheels to the right and bucked drifts along the top till he got to the rounded, wind-swept edge where the grass was bare. All the coulees in this country ran east and south. If he went far enough west, he ought to head this one. He came to the head and saw the shack at the same time. It was a one-room, slant-roofed lean-to, covered with tar paper outside and striped vertically with lath. He had pulled into the yard, his eye on the thin smoke from the stovepipe, before he recognized the place as Ole Peterson's. He swore unbelievingly. He was within 6 miles of his own farm and hadn't recognized a thing till he bumped into Ole's yard. But at least he was somewhere. Ole Peterson was a dumb Swede, but his fire was as warm as anybody's. Feeling good again now that he had passed the bad part, now that Montana lay ahead of him with marked roads, he hammered on the door. Inside he heard movement. He hammered again. "Hey, Ole!" he said. The door opened, and Ole Peterson, taller than the door by a good 2 inches, stood there stooping. He wore a black sweater with a wide orange stripe around the middle like the stripe of a Poland hog. His pale hair was wistfully on end, as if he had been lying down, and his eyes were suspicious. "Hi," Bo said. He started in, but Ole half-closed the door, keeping his long, melancholy face in the crack.
"I don't think you better come in here," he said.
"Why? What's the matter?"
"Anything," Ole said wearily. "Ain't anything matter, but I don't think you better come in."
"What the hell?" Bo said. He peered at Ole's pale, long-cheeked face. "You sick?"
"No," Ole said. "I ban't sick. I just don't want to get sick. I don't want to run you out, but you better go on."
"Hell," Bo said. "I couldn't give you the flu. I haven't got it."
"Where you come from? Whitemud?"
"Yeah, and there's no flu there. Come on, let me in. I'm cold."
"Well, I don't know."
With one quick step, Bo crowded into the shack. "Hell's a fire," he said. "You don't need to be scared of me. I'm healthy." Ole backed up till he sat down on the bunk in the corner. He ran a great splay hand through his hair.
"I wish you didn't come in here," he said.
Bo had his mitts off, warming his hands over the stove. "Take it easy. How long have you been holed up?"
2 weeks.
"Haven't you seen anybody all that time?"
2 farmers, Ole said. "I'd rather be alone than catch flu."
Bo eyed him, half in contempt. His fingers tingled with the heat, and he felt his toes stiff and deeply aching when he set his weight on one foot or the other. Opening the box of lunch, he spread bread and butter and chicken on the table. A half-sandwich went down in 2 bites, and he sank his teeth in a drumstick, cold and meaty and succulent.
"Help yourself,"
he said, with his mouth full. Ole looked, but made no move. So Bo picked up the other drumstick and tossed it to him. He caught it clumsily in his lap and sat holding it, lugubrious and stubborn. Bo dropped the leg bone in the pail behind the stove and started on a second joint.
"Why don't you go into town where the doctors are if you're scared of the flu?" he said.
Ole shook his head.
"He don't want to go to town."
His face, which had been pale as cheese when Bo came in, was flushed now, clear to the roots of the yellow hair. Maybe the big dumb guy was sick and didn't know it.
"I'm going into Chinook if you want to come along," Bo said.
When Ole shook his head again, Bo shrugged and pulled on his mitts, rolling the remains of the chicken in its napkin.
"Well, that's your lookout," he said. "Thanks for the hospitality."
Ole sat on his bunk and, with obvious relief, watched him get ready to go.
"How do I get to the Chinook Road?" Bo said. "Up along your fence?"
"It's a half mile," Ole said. "Turn right at the corner."
"Sure you don't want to come in?"
"I think I stay here."
Bo shrugged and left him. He bumped down across the flats, turned right at the fence corner, and found the road. 15 minutes later he was on the narrow graded road coming up past Cree in Montana, and with a contented sigh he settled back to let the Ford plow ahead. It was easy from here. 3 hours and he'd be in Chinook. 8 hours for the whole 100 miles. That was good time, considering. And coming back he'd have his own tracks to follow. At 4 o'clock, the sun already a dry yellow ball in the haze, he pulled into the empty street and stopped before the Palace Hotel. With the bag of money under his coat he climbed out, stiff and clumsy with cold, and stepped up on the plank sidewalk. It was funny there wasn't anyone around. Not a man, not a horse, not a sleigh or a car was in the street. The hotel front was blank. He saw his own fur reflection coming to meet him in the front window, and the door, when he thumbed the latch and put his shoulder against the panel, was locked.
"Well, I'll be—" he said.
He cupped a hand over his eyes and put his nose against the glass. The desk was there, deserted. The chairs were there, the big-bellied stove, but there was no sign of life. Bo stepped back, his chest beginning to churn with slow rage. Now what if the flu had closed up the whole place? What if the saloons were closed? With narrowed eyes and lips compressed, he started walking. He saw the white flutter of paper on the saloon door before he reached the corner. "Closed while the flu is on," it said. "City ordinance." Savagely, his feet beginning to ache as walking brought the blood back, he cut across the deserted street to the other saloon, where he had bought beer last summer. There was no sign up, but the doors were locked. Involuntary swearing broke out of him. No place to sleep. Not a joint in the whole stinking, cowardly town open. No place to buy the whiskey he had driven 100 cold miles for. But by God, somebody would have to open up or he'd beat their door down. He had knocked without success on 3 doors, up the street past the business section, when he saw a man hurrying along the opposite sidewalk. The man wore a white mask over his face, and his head was covered by a heavy fur cap with deep earlaps. Bo crossed over.
"What's the matter around here?" he said.
The man's eyes, sharp black holes between brown fur and white mask, darted at him, looked him up and down.
"Where'd you come from?"
Bo let his face go dead and stupid.
"I just come in off the farm. What's the matter? There ain't a place in town open." "We got the flu," the man said. "The place is quarantined."
"Good gosh," Bo said.
"Is that right?"
He kept the man standing impatiently while he fingered his chin.
"Hell, I wanted to buy me some whiskey," he said. "I heard there was this flu around, but I didn't know it was in town here."
"Everything's closed," the man said. "You can't even leave town now you're in."
He seemed rather pleased to see Bo stuck.
"You got to get a mask, too. That's orders."
"How'd I get a mask if nothing's open?"
"Hospital," the man said. "Block up the first cross street on the right."
He started off, but Bo laid a hand on his arm.
"Look," he said, "if I can't get out of here, I still want a bottle or two.
Where's a barkeep or somebody live?"
The man laughed. "The whole bunch from Last Chance is in the hospital."
"Isn't there another one?"
"There's a Silver Dollar. Frank Selby lives right back of the joint, but you won't get him to open up."
"Well, I guess I'll try anyway," Beau said.
He watched the man's slight, hurrying figure go up the street and wrinkled his lip and spat in the snow. The Silver Dollar Saloon ran back from a two-story false front for 70 or 80 feet, a bare blank wall for half its length. At the back end, where it became living quarters, there were two windows and a door approached by three wooden steps. The green shades were drawn on the windows. Beau went up the steps, the bag of money under his coat, and knocked. For 2 minutes he waited without an answer. He banged on the storm door with the whole weight of his fist. One of the blinds, he thought, twitched slightly, but no one came to the door. He lifted his fist and thundered on the wood.
"Who's there?"
a woman's voice whined suddenly. She must have tiptoed to the door, for the voice came directly through the boards in front of him.
"I have to see Frank Selby," Beau said. "It's important."
"He isn't seeing anybody,"
the woman said.
"He's got to see me," Beau said. "The doctor sent me."
There was a moment's silence. Then the inner door was opened, and the woman's face looked at him through the little window in the storm door. She had a red, wet-looking hair lip.
"What's the doctor want?"
she said.
"I'm from Harlem. The doctor sent me over for whiskey for medicine."
The woman shook her head.
"You'll have to get it somewheres else. We're closed."
Quietly, out of her sight, Beau put his thumb on the storm door latch, depressed it gently. As she started to shut the inner door, he opened the outer one swiftly and stuck his foot in the crack. The woman confronted him furiously, shoving at the blocked door.
"Go away," she said. "You can't come butting in here."
Beau took the bag from under his coat.
"Look," he said, "I was sent over here in an emergency. I want $300 worth of liquor for that whole town, and I'm not going back without it. You think I drove over here for fun?"
The woman stared at the bag, then at him. She licked the red split in her lip. Still exerting pressure on the door, she called,
"Frank!"
In a minute her husband's face appeared over hers in the crack, a fat face, bartender pale, with drooping, sandy mustaches.
"What is this?" he said. "What you trying to do?"
Lifting the bag before the man's hard eyes, Beau said,
"I was sent over from Harlem for a carload of whiskey. They need it for flu medicine."
Both faces remained stuck behind the door's edge.
"Jesus, man," Frank said, "I can't sell you nothing. The law's closed me up on account of this here epidermic."
Beau rattled the bag.
"I guess $300 ought to be worth opening up for." "What's the matter with Joe's place in Harlem? He's burned down. That's why I had to come over here."
Frank eyed the bag again.
"All right," he said finally. "You wait right there."
Beau took his foot out of the door, and it closed smartly. He laughed. In 5 minutes, Frank came out, a sheepskin around his ears, the strings of a flu mask dangling inside it, and a muffler wrapped around mouth and nose.
"Afraid of freezing your handlebars?" Beau said. "Go ahead and laugh," said Selby, through the muffler and mask. "You stay 6 feet away from me if you want me to sell you anything. Where's your car?"
"In front of the palace."
"Drive it around behind the joint, clear around the house part and halfway up the inside. I don't want anybody snooping around."
When Beau brought the Ford around, Frank opened a side door and backed away to a safe distance.
"All right," he said. "What you want now?"
"Got any kegs of rye?"
"Couple."
"How much?"
"I'd have to figure,"
Frank said. He figured.
96.
"Okay, one of those. How about Irish?"
"How much you want?"
"Case."
"I'll see."
He rummaged among a stack of case goods against the wall. The air in the storeroom was still and cold, full of the smell of whiskey and straw and burlap.
"Here she is," Frank said.
He swung the case out by its burlap ear.
"What else?"
7 cases middle price bourbon, Beau said. "What you got?"
He took a bottle of beer out of an opened barrel and yanked the cap off on a nail head.
The beer was icy cold and faintly skunky. "You ought to keep the light off beer in white bottles," he said. Frank, lifting cases around, only grunted through his muffler. "I'll have to split up on you," he said finally. "I ain't got 7 cases all one kind."
"Okay, long as it isn't rot gut."
Sitting on a box, Bo tipped the beer and watched Frank pull cases together, watched him roll a keg from behind some barrels of beer.
"How much does that come to?" he said.
Frank figured on a barrel head.
294 even."
"Sharpen your pencil a little," Bo said. "This is a wholesale deal."
"Already figured at wholesale. I don't make more than a buck or two a case at that price."
"Tell you what," Bo said. "If it was for me, I'd never buy a bottle of it till I got a jobber's price. When a town buys whiskey for medicine, it ought to get the lowdown. But you throw in another case of bourbon and I'll give you 300 even."
Frank shook his head.
"I couldn't do it. That's a whole case for 6 bucks. I wouldn't make a dime."
"That's the only kind of a deal I'm interested in," Bo said. "I went over to the hospital and talked to the guy from The Last Chance because I couldn't raise anybody out in front here. He wanted to sell me the stuff, but I'd have to hunt up a relative of his to get it. I thought it'd be easier here. But if you don't want to talk business..."
Frank backed away further.
"You been over to the hospital?"
he said. His voice was a squawk.
"What the hell you come around me for?"
"You don't want to do business, huh?"
"All right, take it," Frank said. "Take your 9 cases and get out of here."
"Now you're talking sense," Bo said. He held out the bag, but Frank put his hands behind him.
"Put it on the table," he said.
He stood back while Bo carried the sacks outside.
"I'm not sticking my nose in the car you're driving even," he said.
Bo worked swiftly in the late gray light. The seat took 3 flat cases neatly, and 3 more on top of those brought the load level with the sides. The keg, heavy and clumsy, he wrestled into the foot space in front of the back seat, and one of the 3 remaining cases he wedged beside the keg, padding it with a blanket. The last 2 he put in front, one in the seat and one on the floor. Then he covered the whole load with blankets and threw the gasoline can on top. Frank was still standing back.
"You count out the money," he said. "I'm not touching it till the wife bakes it in the oven."
"Okay," Bo said.
"Strike a light."
Selby lighted a candle, and very carefully and contemptuously, Bo counted out the stacks of dollars and the roll of bills.
"Okay?"
"Okay," Selby said. "Dump 'em back in the bag."
The last thing Bo saw as he backed out of the alley, Frank was carrying the sack before him as if it might explode. He would probably bake the glove he had touched the bag with, too. Bo laughed. As he bumped across the intersection of alley and street, he whistled. The springs hit bottom on the slightest jar. No batting over burnouts on the way back. That was another reason for not starting back now. He'd need daylight to find the road and keep on it. He slept that night at the livery stable, where he found 2 men taking care of a whole barn full of stock belonging to people in the hospital. They didn't want him at first. He loosened them up by going back to the car and breaking out a bottle of bourbon. After that, they let him drive into the grain shed and make himself a bed of hay beside the car. When he lay down in his clothes, the fur coat wrapped around him under the blankets, he heard their voices loud through the partition, heard the stamp and blow of horses and the knocking of a cow's horns against the stanchions. The hay he had piled on the floor rustled under his weight, and sometime during the night he heard a dog sniffing under the shed door. The thought of food for tomorrow crossed his mind, but he let it drift. There was some bread left and a wing of chicken, and if he got an early start, he'd be back in White Mud by early afternoon. Everything was Jake. The bottle to the stablemen was a good investment. Keep them from getting too curious. It was barely daylight when he woke. There was a yellow-spoked wheel directly in front of his eyes, and he lay wondering for a minute. His shoulders and hips were stiff and his feet cold. The wheel revolved a little, stopped, went around a little the other way, and he blinked his eyes clear and saw the car, the crack of light under the shed door. He stood up, stamped his feet, swung his arms. A look into the forge showed him the load untouched. In the other room he heard the stablemen snoring. Driven by ravenous hunger, he went through the partition door and into the stable. There were a half dozen milk pails on a bench. Four cows in improvised stanchions swung their heads to look at him. He hunted up a stool, tipped straw out of a pail, and sat down to the nearest one. The quart of milk he drew down was foamy and warm and slightly sickening, and it spilled on his coat as he tipped the pail to drink, but it laid the devil in his stomach. He drank it all, resting between gulps. The stablemen were still asleep when he went through to the shed. There was the question of warm water for the ford. He turned the radiator petcock and went out in back with a pail. The pump was there, a wide, smooth icicle hanging like a white tongue from its mouth. The pump complained stiffly but finally brought up water, and with the bucket in his hand he went in and started a fire in the sheet-iron stove. When he came in with a second pail, one of the stablemen was sitting up. His face was contracted and his eyes bloodshot. He looked incuriously at Beau for a few minutes and lay down again with his face to the wall. The other one snored on. They were still in their bunks when Beau poured the hot water into the rust-smelling gullet of the ford and bent to crank. At 8 o'clock he was headed out of town, following his own solitary tracks of yesterday. There was not a soul anywhere about, except for a woman who pulled back her front curtains to look as he went by. It was not as clear as it had been the day before. The sun, straight ahead of him for the first 2 miles before the north road switched off, was pale behind a thin screen of mist. Occasional snake trails of snow moved in the road, wriggled a few yards, and died. Inside the side curtains, it did not seem cold. As he drove, Beau was juggling figures. Sometimes, having difficulty keeping them straight in his head, he took his hands off the wheel and drew them in the palm of his mitt. The case to Doc O'Malley would bring him 65. The keg, at $3 a quart, would be another 240. That was his original investment right there. The whole 8 cases of bourbon were gravy. At $4 a bottle, and there were 96 bottles, or 95, since he'd given one to the stablemen, and 4 times 95 was, he figured on his mitt, one eye on the road, 380, all clear profit. Not so bad, he said to the ford, not so bad. He remembered the time only a couple of weeks ago when he had nearly lost his mind because his ducks had spoiled. That all seemed very childish and primitive, something out of the backwoods. One good break, and he was past all that scrabbling for a living. He ate the fragments left in the lunchbox and threw the box out the window. There were no tracks on the straight road except his own. The sun, on his right now, was barely visible through the mist. He took a firmer grip on the wheel and pulled the gas lever down a notch. It might snow, and he needed those tracks. Ahead of him, the erratic wind lifted a trail of dry snow across the road. His feet, unprotected now by a folded blanket, felt the cold first. When he stamped them, he realized that they had been getting colder all the time. In one way, cold was good. There wouldn't be much snow if the temperature dropped. But the road ahead was now crawling with lifting ropes of drift. He swore. Wind was just as bad, worse. It would cover his tracks in an hour if it blew. The sky was grayer now, too, the whole world darkening over the white waste. He dropped the gas lever another notch. Where the road turned off to Cree, he stopped, hesitating between choices. He ought to stop somewhere and get warm, have a cup of coffee before tackling the last 50 miles. But there might be no one left at Cree. His own place would be like an ice house, and the kerosene stove wouldn't do more than warm his hands. The only place he was sure of was Ole's. And Ole wouldn't be tickled to death to see him. He jammed his foot hard on the low pedal. Ole would see him anyway. Rather than risk losing his way, he followed his own tracks, going carefully across the roadless flat and stopping in Ole's yard. The wind blew smoke down to the ground, making him turn his head. The barometer must be clear to the bottom if smoke wouldn't rise. Ole didn't answer his first knock, and he put his shoulder against the door. Locked. He pounded again, listened.
"Come in,"
the Swede's voice said. "The door's locked," Bo yelled.